and the World Service Organization, which we refer to as WSO, of Adult Children of Alcoholics. Our panelists will discuss how to check if your meeting is healthy and how to resolve problems and conflicts that may arise. Here's a quick overview of the next 90 minutes. During this session, you will hear from Lawrence C., who will discuss the process of coming to a group conscience. Following Lawrence, we have three panelists, Aaron, Karen, and Josh, who will share their experience, strength, and hope with a focus on meeting health and safety, and resolving conflict in meetings. Following the presentation, the panelists will answer questions submitted in advance to our website. There are actually four of those, so I'll direct one to each of our panelists. And participants can also ask questions after that. We ask that you submit questions rather than shares, and that they be on the topic of healthy meetings. This meeting will run from 5 to 6:30. We will keep the meeting open until 7 p.m. if there are remaining questions. And if your question is not answered, you can submit it to info@ct-aca.org. And by the way, if some of you are looking for recordings of prior sessions, you will find them at ct-aca.org/media. We want to thank our co-hosts, Liz C., and our technical hosts, Brad and Christopher. A few technical notes. So the speakers and the questions and answers will be recorded. That is the first set that have been submitted in advance. Written permission has been granted. These audio recordings, as I mentioned, will be available on the WSO website. And before that, they will probably be appearing on our own Connecticut Intergroup website. The recordings will be audio only. There will be no video recordings shared. And the participant questions and answers will not be recorded. So if you have problems, there are volunteers who will do their best to answer those problems or concerns in chat. So that would be from you chatting to one of the hosts or organizers if you have a problem. Chat between participants will be disabled during the speaker portions. So I'm happy to announce our first speaker, who is Lawrence. He is from the Innermost Group in East Lyme, Connecticut, a group which he started in the year 2007. He came into 12-step recovery through AA at the age of 31 and first heard the laundry list in 1989. Lawrence has been involved with Connecticut Intergroup since 2008 and has been the chair of literature sales for our state, for which we are very grateful. He gets us literature wherever we are. He brings it to us. So Lawrence, the floor is yours, and let me see if I can share my screen, because I know you're going to be working with a PowerPoint. So hold on a second.
I am Lawrence, and I am an adult child. The topic for me is healthy meetings and how to keep a meeting healthy, and just one of the things I'd like to present is the simple fact that, you know, growing up in a dysfunctional home, there was two things that I was, that I lived day in and day out for the first 17 years of my life. And the two things that that I had to live with is constantly walking on eggshells. I'm sure none of you understand that. And not talking about the pink elephant in the room. And at a very early time in my recovery, I told myself I would not do that in my adult life. And for that, I was on a quest for healthy communication between any of my relations, and have worked on it for a very long time. And with that being said, I have spent days and days and days in meetings in my recovery. I've been fully involved in my recovery. My average is 3 to 4 meetings a week on a constant basis, and that has been for a lot of years. So one of the things that I clearly have done is I have fit my life into recovery. I have not fit recovery into my life, and it just seems to work a whole lot better that way for me. With that being said, I'd like to begin about having And yes, I do need a timer, whoever's doing that, because I can get a little long-winded or a little off the beaten path in a heartbeat. So here it is in a nutshell, the first piece to a healthy business meeting and or group conscience meeting. I have found that an opening statement for business meetings and or group conscience meetings are very, very helpful in relaying the message of what we're looking to accomplish. And on the PowerPoint, the beginning is the opening statement for a business meeting that feels comfortable to me and really covers a lot of territory. It is in a couple of the groups that I have. And so as we begin this group business meeting today, let us remember tradition 2 states in part, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority. A loving God is expressed in our group conscience. You know, and tradition 5 states each group has but one primary purpose, to carry the message to the adult child who still suffers. Very imperative in my belief system that we continue to look to reach out to that adult child who still suffers. And if we could keep that up front and center, our business at hand really, really helps a lot. And then how best to carry that message is the focus of our business meeting here today. Ultimately, again, it goes back to that new person coming in and quite often questioning whether or not this is something that they have been looking for or is needed in their life. You know, it is important that all members, this is the next, Christine, next PowerPoint?
Yes.
Do I get to do it or you?
You. So it's the second half of the opening statement.
Right, right. It is important that all members are heard so we can reach an informed group conscience. You know, and what this presentation is going to do is to describe what that informed group conscience is, and thus maintain the unity and strength so vital to our fellowship. Please be patient and allow whoever is speaking to finish. We also ask that you be recognized by the secretary before speaking, or whoever is facilitating that particular meeting.
Sorry. My bad. Okay. We're going to do this again. Okay.
Let us therefore have the patience and tolerance to listen while others share, the courage to speak up when we have something to share, and the wisdom to do what is right for our group and ACA as a whole. And it's really, I really have to say thank you to Charlie F. for this. He has been able to incorporate this statement into the very principles of our program. You know, I'm a big believer in that second piece that says the courage to speak up when we have something to share. So often I witness people that because of the family dysfunction in their upbringing, they not only have lost their voice, but have difficulty finding it. And each and every one of us has an equal and valuable voice. No one is above any other, you know, and it's nurturing and encouraging people to speak their truth. So with that being said, you know, the next piece that we go into is, what is a group conscience? You know, the collective conscience of the group membership. It strives for substantial unanimity. What the hell is substantial unanimity, I ask, you know? We'll get to that down the road. And it is a clear sense of the collective view emerges. Spirituality and placing principles before personality. adherence to the steps, traditions, and concepts, the things that keep us reaching higher ground as individuals and as a group. So, and ACA as a whole, you know, so that this beautiful program will be available to our grandkids if that's what's needed, you know, and for others to come. So the next PowerPoint is what is substantial unanimity? It's agreement by all, or for those who do not agree, it's a question they ask themselves. I understand the issue. I have been heard. I don't fully agree, but I can accept the majority group opinion. And that's pretty much what substantial unanimity is. We all don't have to agree 100%. But because of the first tradition, which states group unity comes first. Individual recovery is important and takes a close back second, but group unity is what comes first. So can I live with this? Is a real, real good question for any individual to ask themselves. It's not about whether or not I'm right and you're wrong or vice versa. As a collective group, can we live with this? And can we move on to newer and other business that takes place? I did not come in for myself. I did not come in to 12-step recovery to sit in circle and argue, and not get anything done. I did not come into recovery to practice walking on eggshells. I did not come into recovery just to take a look at the pink elephant and not ever speak a word about it. I needed a solution to my communication and my skills and my ability to be with others, whether or not it's individually or as a group. So then the next PowerPoint is, what is the process for a group conscience? A group conscience usually involves a serious issue or an issue that really needs to be addressed. And it doesn't need to be addressed just for that particular moment or time frame, although that's what it comes about. It's also for the long-term result, which is, you know, this, the resolvement that we could come up with can last longer than just why this issue is happening right this moment. So what do? The first thing we do is realize we don't have to live in 911s all our life. Slow down. Recognize that there is no emergency. Avoid addiction to excitement, fixing and rescuing mentality, fear of authority figures, the group chair and or the loudest voice in the room could quite be that authority figure in our regression. They are not an authority figure. They are just another individual that is looking for resolve. So the next screen, it says how to identify issues for a group conscience. So once an issue is identified, the secretary will announce that at a set date, a group conscience will be held on that issue. Again, it doesn't have to be a secretary, but it does a trusted servant within the arena or the group meeting or whatever the case may be. So what are we going to do? I'm going to throw out an example to you in how this works. First thing is, or the next screen talks about bringing dogs to meetings. Jeez, pretty much an open thing. Quite often happens. So, how does the group resolve this issue? Secretary announces there will be a meeting in 2 weeks in regards to bringing in dogs. Now, the secretary makes that announcement because at some point within the meeting, there was somebody that may have been disgruntled, or somebody was speaking with another person and says, you know, I like this meeting, but, you know, how dare they bring dogs?
Lawrence, that's 5 minutes left.
Thank you. Secretary announces there will be a meeting in 2 weeks regarding bringing dogs. At the regular meeting, secretary will raise the issue of bringing dogs to the meeting before any formal motion is made, allowing the group members to identify and study pertinent information in regards to the dogs. So then we wait for outside information. We ask that anyone is interested, do research and bring information to the group conscience meeting. Meeting room policy, maybe the church won't allow dogs. People with allergic reactions. There are people out there with allergic reactions to hair, dogs, different things like that. Laws on comfort animals. And then any other things. There could be a plethora, but remember, again, we don't do this in an emergency situation. We do our homework, we do our footwork, and we bring it back to have the group conscience. So then we get into sharing the opinions. We actually come together afterwards. Secretary announces issue, reads the opening statement, and opens for sharing at group conscience meeting. Each person who wishes to share has 2 to 3 minutes to share. No member should share twice until everyone in the room has a chance to be heard. Once this is done, then the secretary or whoever is facilitating the group conscience shares. They wait until everyone shares because, in all essence, the secretary may look like an authority figure and may look like, you know, other individuals are looking for their opinion. So they wait until everyone has shared. We come up to the motion now. The secretary entertains a motion. Someone in the majority makes a clear motion, We need to know exactly what we're looking to vote on. I move that no dogs be allowed in our ACA meeting. Other issues have need to be clarified much more. This is pretty basic. After a motion is made and seconded, a vote is taken. A motion passes with substantial unanimity. If no substantial unanimity, the minority is asked to speak. Secretary asks if anyone wishes to change their vote. If yes, they do a revote. If no substantial unanimity, the issue would be tabled. If there is no substantial unanimity, the issue would be tabled for further dialogue. Again, we're not in a rush for this important matter. We can table it and bring more information to it. And at the very end, it says reaffirming. The group conscience is a more infallible guide for group affairs than any individual member, however good or wise they may be. We avoid depending on any leader because our active leadership is truly rotating. We enjoy a democracy unavailable anywhere else. We in ACA are certain of an ultimate authority, a loving God as expressed in our group conscience. I really appreciate being able to share this with everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Thanks, Lawrence.
Thank you, Lawrence.
So our next speaker is Karen S. Karen came into ACA in the DC area 12 years ago. where she was involved in establishing the National Capital Area ACA Intergroup, serving as its first chair before moving to Illinois in 2018. In 2017, she was one of a small group of women who decided to raise a concern about an active occurrence of predatory behavior in the area to the intergroup. Based on her firsthand experience with the issue, she then decided to join the Addressing Predatory Behavior Working Group, which is known as the APB. So the goal of that working group is to help develop resources to support meetings and members in dealing with issues of safety, and to help create safe spaces within the fellowship where discussions can occur. Karen is also involved in the concept study group and the newly formed ad hoc committee on meeting and service safety. Wow, that's a lot of interesting stuff to hear about. So here is Karen. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. And I want to first say thank you to Liz and the Connecticut Intergroup team planning this workshop for reaching out with the invitation to speak here. I also, before I start my own share, I just want to say we have three panelists from the APB working group or who have worked together in the last 2 years in the APB working group speaking this afternoon. And I'm just going to start off the discussion. Aaron and Josh will follow with their own perspectives. And we decided for today's workshop to keep it really on our personal experience with this topic. What got us interested in predatory behavior in the first place, and how did we get involved in doing more extensive service work on meeting and service safety? That's what the focus of today's discussion will be. I'll just sort of give a teaser. Liz, if you'll allow, we are going to be doing a more extensive workshop on how do the traditions and the concepts of service and the commitment to service apply to specific scenarios of meeting safety in a couple of weeks. But today I just want to jump in and talk about like what was my experience with predatory behavior coming into ACA, and how did I end up getting involved in doing service on this topic, which I consider to be a pretty important topic. And so I got into recovery about 12 years ago. I was living in DC at the time. I now live in Illinois. And I was really new and really hurting. I got into recovery at a very low point in my life. I was in a lot of pain, and I was very eager to learn anything that could help me move beyond that level of pain. And so I was accosted by somebody in the first couple of weeks of coming to meetings who was basically, he was presenting himself as a long-term member. He was coordinating a meeting list of any meetings related to adult child issues in the DC area, whether they were ACA meetings or Al-Anon meetings with adult child focus. And so he seemed to know a few things, and he approached me after meetings, sort of extending some sort of sympathy and compassion for what I was sharing about and offering support. And I kind of took him up on that because I was so eager to learn. I also very quickly realized I was feeling very uncomfortable in that situation because this gentleman was sort of coming very close physically. He would stick around in meetings with me after the meeting had already closed and people had left. At one point, he was sitting directly next to me. He was holding my hand. He was sort of offering all kinds of guidance and support. And I wasn't sure how much of it really related with what I was starting to learn about 12-step recovery. But like I said, I was hurting. I was eager to take it in. And he wanted more connection with me. He wanted to talk more. He was sort of soliciting me to call him and all of that stuff. And I was uncomfortable, but I wasn't recovered enough to really trust that sense of uncomfortability. And what happened next was really sort of my higher power looking out for me in the early days of my recovery. That's the only way I can make sense of it, because at one point, at one of the meetings I was at, sort of thinking about like maybe connecting with this gentleman after the meeting and talking more, another person, another gentleman actually, as it happened, just sort of offhandedly during halftime made a comment to me about the rule in 12-step recovery of not sort of crossing gender in sponsorship, sort of men work with men, women work with women. And when I sort of expressed curiosity, interest, he was like, yeah, it gets really complicated if you don't follow that rule. And that was the first time I was hearing about that. I've since read about 13 stepping in the Big Red Book. But for me, it was the first time I heard, oh, there's a rule about that. There's a boundary within the program I'm in about that. And it just immediately made everything fall into place for me. And I was like, oh, that's why this is making me feel so uncomfortable. It validated my own sense of discomfort about the situation. And so I started backing away. I started setting boundaries. This individual was not receiving that very well. At one other point, also in these first few months that I was attending meetings, he was kind of lingering at the door of a meeting room while I was inside talking to other fellow travelers. And when I finally tried to leave the room, he blocked the door and basically demanded a hug from me. And when I did not grant that hug, when I maintained my boundary and said I really felt uncomfortable doing that, he got unpleasant. And there were other instances where he would just keep approaching me. He couldn't take the cues that I was sending about I really want to keep my distance. But eventually I would say he just lost interest because I was sticking to my guns, and he moved on. And I saw him doing the same behavior with other female newcomers. And so for a while, I would just keep my eye open when these other female newcomers were talking to him. And fortunately, there was never a situation that I thought was so critical that I needed to sort of jump in and run some kind of intervention. But I was vigilant about his behavior. Eventually, after a while, let's say 2 or 3 years, actually what happened was that the meetings that I was going to, he just kind of stopped attending. He might show up here and there once periodically, but essentially he stopped attending. So I didn't have to deal with the issue anymore. And I thought that was fine. I didn't have to be concerned with his behavior at other meetings. I was fine. He wasn't bothering me at my meetings anymore. So during this entire time, I did not talk to a single other person about what was happening. During this time and after this time, I did not talk to a single other person about what was happening. I was just uncomfortable. I did what I needed to do in terms of setting personal boundaries, and I didn't talk about it. Does that remind us of something? Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. It's the rules of dysfunctional families. That's how we survive in dysfunctional families. Looking back, I'm asking myself today, why did I stay silent for 8 years? Because eventually I did speak up. I'm speaking up today, but why did I stay silent for 8 years? And I came up with 3 reasons that I just want to touch on briefly here today. One of them was that I misunderstood the program principles and applied them to the situation in a way that worked for me, but I would still say they reflect a misunderstanding of how the program works. The program taught me to keep the focus on myself and not on the other person, to change what I can change, my own behavior, and accept the things I cannot change, the other person's behavior. So I did that, it worked for me, and I left it at that. But there were other reasons, sort of more hidden reasons, why I never spoke up about my experience. One of them was fear. I was really, truly afraid that if I dared call out the behavior and said, this guy is doing something really creepy and I see him not just doing it to me, but to other women, I would cause conflict in the meetings I was attending. And I depended on these meetings so much that I did not want to risk causing conflict. I didn't want to be forced to leave the meetings because of such a conflict. And so I was bringing my personal life history of feeling ostracized in family groups and sort of social settings because of speaking up for myself, standing up for what I thought was right. I was bringing that to my recovery, and I was afraid to speak up. And then the last reason I want to touch on here is shame. I was holding on for the longest time to a belief that the behavior that this person was doing was in some way normal and to be expected from men, and that my job as a reputable woman was to establish and enforce healthier, stronger boundaries for myself, and that my unrecovered inability to establish those healthier boundaries was actually a stain on my reputation as a woman. So I was bringing my personal shame into this whole discussion, but I would also say, sort of after the Me Too movement, I can say I was bringing sort of a whole cultural belief system about how men act in public and how women should act in public into this whole discussion. And that prevented me from speaking up. Needless to say, I did eventually speak up. And I wanted to talk about what happened when I did start to break my silence. For one thing, what happened before I started to break my silence was that I became involved in establishing the intergroup in the DC area. We were able as a group to sort of leverage a lot of energy and a lot of interest in the intergroup in a very short period of time. And so within a year, we were hosting our first Recovery Day annual workshop. And this gentleman was invited to be a speaker at the workshop. Did I speak up then? No. I was uncomfortable at the idea that people seemed to value him in a way that would give him the platform to speak at a local recovery workshop, but I did not feel comfortable speaking up about my experience with him, my concerns about his integrity and his honesty in his approach to recovery. Then a year later, we were in the planning stages for the next Recovery Day event, and this person was again involved in the planning process and also preparing to be a speaker. A friend of mine was also involved and was venting frustration about I don't remember the details, but something regarding this particular individual. And all of a sudden, my whole history with this individual, my concerns about this individual just kind of erupted out of me. I just sort of shared, blurted it all out. And mostly what happened was I was startled about the intensity of my feelings about the situation. I can't really say much more than that. I was just like, oh my God, there are so much feelings attached to this. There must be some unfinished business that I have here. Nothing much happened for another year until my friend approached me about the situation again, because my friend was starting to hear from other women who were newer to recovery that they were having similar experiences with this particular individual. And so we were like connecting the dots. Yeah, he did it X number of years ago. At this point, I think we're talking 9 years ago, 9 years ago, 10 years ago. And he's still doing it. So there's like an entrenched pattern here. Does it make sense? Is there something that we can do, knowing that there's this pattern, having spoken to other people who are affected, having concerns about the fact that this individual is getting the opportunity again and again to talk about his very unique perspective on recovery at our Recovery Day workshops in intergroup? Is there something that we can do to address it?
Three minutes left.
Thank you. We did decide to bring it up to the intergroup. It was me and I think first one, then two other women who agreed to share our stories with intergroup. And we did decide to bring it up because we felt like it's happening at a number of different meetings. So it's affecting multiple meetings in the area. And it's also sort of a problem that he might be sort of using his presence at intergroup activity to sort of create that ambience of authority that newcomers might be fooled by. And there were a number of things that happened as a result of bringing it up at the intergroup. One of them was that For one thing, for me, most strikingly was actually that when we did share this at intergroup, I could see, I was physically present when we did this. I could see everybody who was at the meeting nodding in recognition, not just of the behavior, but of the person that we were talking about. And all of a sudden it's like, yeah, we've been witnessing this for a long time. The women in our meeting have been dealing with this in sometimes very sort of subversive ways, walking each other out of meetings so as to avoid a confrontation with this individual. We know what's going on. We are completely on board with addressing it. Now, what do we need to do? And so we were able to document that this person was acting as a meeting contact for some local meetings that weren't following the traditions, and that were also really doing more to deter newcomers because he was sort of preying on them and scaring them away than to get them engaged in recovery. So we made the decision locally to delist those meetings from our local meeting list. And we also reached out to WSO with the recommendation to delist these meetings from the WSO meeting list. WSO took our concerns seriously, temporarily delisted those meetings, reached out to the individual, gave him the opportunity to present his own perspective on what was going on. And I think ultimately those meetings were completely delisted. On the intergroup level, we also had a conversation. We reached out to the individual in writing and then offered a sit-down meeting, which eventually happened, to just explain to him what our observations were, what our concerns were, giving him the opportunity to object and maybe refute our perspective, but also to maybe hear what we were saying and take that into consideration as he was working through his own issues here. And lastly, we developed a flyer that we made available to local meetings, providing resources in ACA literature, at this time specifically the Big Red Book, to help meetings identify and work through issues with predatory behavior should they arise in their meetings. Parentheses, should this person show up at one of these meetings and try to do his behavior there? What can meetings do to sort of gear up and defend against this happening to newcomers at area meetings? And so I'll leave my personal share of about the situation at that. I just want to say a few things about how breaking my silence affected me personally, because this process for me was a very profound experience. Lawrence was talking earlier about the importance of finding our voice. We don't have a voice growing up in dysfunctional homes, and it's really hard, and sometimes beyond hard, to find our voice and to risk speaking up. And so this has been a very profound experience for me. For one thing, I was just startled by the intensity that I had when I first even spoke about the situation, realizing, oh, there's some unfinished business here. Also, having the validation of intergroup recognizing my concern and taking on my personal concern as something that needed to be addressed at the intergroup level was really empowering and encouraging for me, and sort of gave me a different sense of feeling supported in this fellowship that has been such a big part of my life for the last 12 years. And then I was forced to adjust my belief system about what is normal and what is acceptable behavior as sort of we talked things through, and my own assessment of how harmful this behavior can be has changed. And then lastly, my focus has shifted dramatically. Remember how I was talking about earlier, I need to keep my own boundaries and everything else is beyond my control? Yes, that was true for me in the early days of recovery. But at this point, I am much more interested in talking about, like, what is the responsibility that we have as a group and as trusted servants in our fellowship to maintain and enforce boundaries within our meetings and within our fellowship? Because really, I feel like several traditions sort of touch on this and really make it clear to me that this is a shared responsibility, not an individual responsibility. For one thing, this kind of behavior affects our common welfare as a meeting and as a fellowship, and therefore it affects the benefit that we each receive from recovery. That's referenced in Tradition 1, which states our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on ACA unity. So if my fellowship is strong, my recovery can thrive. Otherwise, I might just be stuck in the laundry list traits forever and ever. Secondly, this kind of behavior affects our experience of leadership within the fellowship and our ability to trust our service leaders and be trusted as service leaders. Because if we have these bad apples in our midst who are abusing the authority that they claim they have as the chair of a meeting or as the secretary of a meeting, or just because they've been around the rooms for 25 years, that lets us lose our faith in service. That lets us lose our faith in the higher power that guides us in the process of recovery, which is related to tradition too. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. So if we don't trust our leaders, we can't have a functioning process of recovery. And then the last tradition I want to reference here is the ability that we have to carry the message to the newcomer who still suffers, as referenced in tradition 5. If newcomers are scared away from meetings because there are people out there who are preying on them, trying to take advantage of their vulnerability as a newcomer to the program, then they're just gonna run away and go somewhere else or keep acting out on their behavior. They're not gonna stick around in the rooms of ACA recovery and find the true healing that is possible if we follow this program. And with that, I'm gonna wrap it up, and thank you so much for letting me share this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Kara.
That was fabulous, thank you so much. Our next speaker is Erin D. Erin is celebrating 26 years of active ACA recovery this year. She holds several service positions at the WSO level, including serving on the Board of Trustees. Currently, she is working with a team developing norms of conduct for the board and WSO service positions with the goal of creating a sense of trust, safety, community, love, and respect. Erin is the vice chair of the Addressing Predatory Behavior Committee and the chair of Meeting Safety and Service Committee. So, here is Erin D. Who may still be muted, I don't know.
Unmute myself, okay.
Hi, Erin.
Hi, sorry about that. I couldn't figure out how I was supposed to mute or unmute myself. I was going back and forth there. I'll add one little correction there. The board norms of conduct actually they're already written, but they are currently, part of what the OPPM says is that we need to be cognizant of them and what direction they're going, how they're working, and that. And one of the tasks, which I think is certainly related to the things we're talking about today, is that we are looking at how these board norms of conduct actually can apply to norms of conduct throughout service. So all the different committees and things like that, and looking at different resources that will help in many ways, and things that we're specifically, many of the things that we're talking about today. Hoping my dog is not going to start barking here. So the how and why of my getting involved in meeting safety issues, addressing predatory behavior, for me came about when I started off as vice chair and then chair of the delegate training subcommittee. And during the first year that I presented to the delegates, the topic that was really being asked for was, how do we keep that meeting so that people aren't being so triggered, and so that it would be, you know, more healthy, emotionally productive and stuff. And some of the things that we talked about there were the ACA commitment to service. And when I'm in a meeting, I really like a business sort of meeting. I really like to read that commitment to service because it really helps remind me and ground me of why I'm there, what my purpose is. And two of those out of that commitment to service, which is Big Red Book, page 601, that I find really important to meeting safety is the second one, which is the viewpoint of the minority, but that it says, so confirming that our process is one of inclusion and not exclusion, and then showing special sensitivity to the viewpoint of the minority in the process of formulating the group conscience so that any decision is reflective of the spirit of the group and not just the voice of the majority. And even with, you know, tradition too, you know, that it's a loving higher power, higher presence. The other one is the eighth commitment to service, being willing to surrender the position I hold, of which I serve, in the interest of unity, to provide the opportunity for others to share, to serve, to avoid problems of money, property, and prestige, and here's the big ones for me, avoid losing my own recovery through the use of service to act out my old behavior, especially in taking care of others, controlling, rescuing, and being a victim. And I think that's one of the things that is seen replayed over and over again in our more unhealthy scenarios of meetings or business meetings. And the other thing, this sounds like a weird thing to say, but this is like one of my favorite paragraphs in the Big Red Book, and it's really strange that it would be a favorite, but it always stands out for me. And this is, many of us arrive, and this is from Tradition 9, many of us arrive at ACA wounded and angry. We hurt, so we want to hurt others. However, no one has the right to harm anyone in ACA. We must avoid our misguided attempt to recreate our dysfunctional family system through the ACA group. Angry or disruptive members are usually acting out their family role, unknowingly reconstructing their dysfunctional family setting. Some of us can relate to this claim. We realize that our disruptive behavior allowed us to blame the group, and we could avoid working on ourselves by blaming the group members for imagined wrongs and slights. The tolerance we found in ACA allowed many of us to change. And when we talk about, you know, Tradition 1 and unity, I remember in a meeting once, it was Charlie H. who said something that really, really stayed with me. And what it was, unity, let me see where I have that one written down here. Unity depends, personal recovery depends on group unity, and yet unity actually depends on personal recovery. You know, and how important those two things have to be in order to get unity to work within that group process. I have certainly seen, and therefore why it became important to me to work on issues regarding meeting safety, the three reasons that are the typical scenarios that play out, as states in Tradition 1, interpersonal squabbling between members, the suspicions on handling money, and older members gripping with control. And, you know, my experience isn't always that it's older members gripping with control, but it's that we as ACAs on that other side of the laundry list gripping with control. And how it says in there that the group's future and sustainability hang in the balance. I have one of my slogans of the three C's, not the didn't cause it, can't control it, and can't cure it, but mine is choose curiosity over criticism. So when in a business meeting, that's one of the slogans that I try to use for myself. The other one is tackle the problem, not the person, and that I am willing to fail and learn from it. And that, to me, comes out when, you know, we're making a decision in a business meeting and we're having the discussion and then the vote happens. And it's a vote that in my mind, I just kind of go, oh, no, I can see where this is going. But we as a group have the right to be wrong and to learn from that mistake. And that's experience, strength, and hope. And that's when I need to get out of the way and let a higher purpose prevail so that the group actually becomes stronger from that. Let's see. and I'm, you know, as anyone knows me, I love the traditions. To me, they're all about how do we keep it safe. The spiritual principles behind the tradition for me are very much like what I try to use as a guiding force in my life. As it says, we practice these principles in all our affairs. I really found my path to my higher power, which I call my higher purpose. I found that path through the traditions. So into some personal experience of things that I've observed in meetings and why I got more involved over the years, different scenarios. We had one person that, you know, today, looking at it now, yes, it's predatory behavior. Back then it was like, this isn't right. We had a gentleman who would go right up to the new women who came into the group every single meeting. He would go up and ask them for a hug. And, you know, in his mind, he was trying to, you know, be welcoming. And I think it's that unconscious behavior where it's our psychological unmet needs that we're acting on that we don't realize. And sometimes we do realize, but a lot of times we don't realize what we're doing. And it was a good friend of mine that I had invited to the meeting. He went right up to her after the meeting, basically, you know, tried to get a hug from her, and she called me on the ride home and she was like, I'm never going back. So there you go. I remember hearing my husband say to me, this was many years ago when I was at an ACA meeting, and my husband had asked me when I came home, was so-and-so at the meeting? And it was someone that I didn't know to our meeting, but he was in another program. And I was like, yeah, he was at the meeting, you know, and like really didn't share, you know. So there goes the anonymity. And then my husband proceeded to tell me that him and his friend that went to the meeting specifically went there to look for women because they were easy targets at Al-Anon and ACA meetings. So you can kind of see where my evolution is. I want these meetings to be a little bit safer than that. There was also when I was first in ACA, I was in for 5 years, and then because of educational reasons, I ended up not being able to attend meetings. And when I went back, there was a young guy who basically had taken that meeting so that every woman that came in there, he took to coffee afterwards and, you know, tried to have a relationship with. And, you know, it strikes me that when, you know, we, you know, as ACAs, so much of a part of who we are is that triangle of victim, rescuer, persecutor that plays out a lot in the laundry list traits. And that's a lot of real unconscious behavior that that I can get stuck in. The more that I got an understanding of the traditions and the more that I was able to employ, tackle the problem, not the person, choose curiosity over criticism, the more I myself in a healthy way was able to be more solution focused when things like this came up. We had a person once who was very disruptive to the meeting. People were very scared in the meeting. They were scared, not feeling safe. And it was more just an unpredictability. I won't go into too much, but basically to say that it was that. And I had gotten to know the person and really liked the person. I didn't see what they saw, but at the same time, you know, I wanted to defend this person, but at the same time I had to realize, yeah, but that is really how other people are feeling. And my thought to myself was, if this was my son acting that way and I really wanted my son to get recovery, how would I want him to be approached? You know, if I was doing something that was unhealthy in a meeting and was affecting people and triggering people, how would I want to be approached? Because if I keep that if I keep that tradition in mind, you know, my purpose is that, you know, we want people to stay, we want people to recover, because we get so much back from all that. So I'm not going to go into too much more here since there's 3 minutes. You know, I've seen the scenarios of, you know, I call it the sponsor pounce, where someone, you know, is just like trying to get thousands of sponsees, you know, and once again, it's an unmet need. And as my sponsor would say to me, you know, check your motive. Let's see. I'll kind of go to some of what I was going to end on. How I got in with the APB was certainly my own personal story. And for me, it was growing up with sexual incest in the family and really coming to not know that my body belonged to me. You know, I just thought my body belonged to any guy that wanted it and didn't know how to say no. And, you know, the more guys that wanted it, the more valued I was. Somehow that was my self-worth was all tied up in that. And this, you know, it was very, just really manifested into who I was. So I was easy prey, in any sort of a meeting like this, but luckily, when I was married, everybody knew who my husband was because he was in another program and we were very active in fellowship out here. So I was kind of like protected because nobody was going to mess with me because they knew who my husband was. One of the things that he had said to me when it came time to kind of confronting people when I would have this fear of confronting them, and part of that fear I noticed for myself was, you know, my father was my abuser. And I noticed once when I had to talk with my father about something, that I was still frozen with fear to talk to him. And here was my dad, 80 something years old, in a wheelchair. And I was still afraid of being molested, you know, and that fear, you know, was so unconscious. And that fear and so many other behaviors that had manifested from, you know, living in that tunnel vision of abuse, you know, or what kept me not knowing how to keep myself safe. But my husband had said to me, when it came time to kind of confronting somebody who was acting out inappropriately, you know, you really don't have to worry about confronting somebody when they're doing something so out there, because they're used to being confronted over that kind of stuff. And their defense mechanisms are already pretty high about it. So don't be worried about it. Say what you need to say to the person, you know. And you know, that actually really helped me, because it's true. You know, they have heard it before. It's just that I'm the one who's being too fearful and thinking I shouldn't say that. And kind of like what Karen was saying, the whole cultural thing about, you know, I'm a woman, I shouldn't act like that kind of thing. But what's important to me moving forward in this work is finding and empowering each other to speak up. I find that even just with the work that we're looking at with board norms and service norms and bringing it into the fellowship, you know, one of the issues that keep coming back to getting stuck at, how do we move forward, you know, feeling like there's authorities or whatever, it's like, how do we get comfortable speaking up and looking at creating, just like we have today, workshops, events that can help empower us to know that speaking up is our responsibility. It's our recovery. It is why we're here. And you know, as my husband showed me, you know, not to be afraid to do that, because mostly they've heard it before. And also that, you know, most of the people that, you know, I hear, oh, we're afraid to say something because, you know, what's going to come back at me. Now, you know, that person's probably there's probably a lot more than just you that has had issues with that person. So those are kind of my lessons and why I'm here. And thank you so much for having this platform. So very important.
Thank you, Erin.
Thanks, Erin.
And just remember, everybody, that we will be hearing again on August 8th from Erin and Karen and Josh. So you'll have some more opportunities if you've got lots of good questions for her to ask them then as well. So our last speaker for the day is Josh. And Josh has been working his ACA program for about 14 years in Washington, D.C. As part of the National Capital Area Intergroup, he has previously served as WSO rep and ABC delegate. Josh currently serves as secretary of the newly certified Northeast region of ACA, and he holds several service positions at the WSO level, including on the Addressing Predatory Behavior Committee and the Meeting and Service Safety Committee. So Josh, we're eager to hear from you.
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Hi everybody, my name is Josh and I'm a recovering adult child. I'm a grateful one, I thought. So, you know, in thinking through this workshop, one thing that we talked about with Liz is that, as was just mentioned, we're kind of breaking in this into two parts. And so my comments today are going to be geared more towards the newcomer and general principles around meeting safety. And in part, I think that's because there's a lot of nuance to these things as you get deeper. And a lot of the, if you're new, is, I mean, it's just going to go right over your head. So today, I'm going to treat that as my audience. So I would say that, so when we talk about meeting safety, like, what does that mean exactly? And one of the things I you know, saying to Erin and Karen as we were kind of talking about what we were going to talk about, for me, I think one of the most helpful things I could do for a newcomer is to say, well, you know, what is it I wish I had known as a newcomer, you know, and later found out the hard way, you know, maybe save someone some heartache and headache, kind of thing. So I'm going to try to approach it from that angle. And the first thing I would say is, you know, we're talking about meeting safety, but what does safety mean? You know, what goes into that? And, you know, just off the cuff, I kind of think about, well, there's different kinds of safety, right? There's physical safety. There's sort of like safety around any kind of sexuality. There's safety around, there's emotional safety. There's psychological safety. And I think all of these things are different dimensions of something that, to me, altogether comprises a sense of safety. And one thing I think that directly undergirds a sense of safety or lack thereof is boundaries. And I think that boundaries is one of the core things that most ACAs have challenges around. So it's not entirely shocking that there might be some safety issues with a bunch of ACAs. So, yes. So I want to just say too, so for my home group in DC, which I've been going to for, I don't know, over 10 years, a while now, probably about 14 years. Yeah, maybe 13 years. we currently have a pretty healthy, functional business meeting. It was not always that way. There were years when our business meetings were a giant cluster. And somehow we got from there to here. And that, what I will say is, like, that was a years-long process. Multi-years. And, I mean, the way things started out is we couldn't... Our sort of ACA issues were so dominating our business meetings that we couldn't even agree on how to discuss an issue, let alone actually discuss the issue. So it would look like getting into arguments of, are we using Robert's rules? You can't tell me to use Robert's rules. Okay, then so should we have a business meeting about, you know, if we're going to use Robert's rules? Okay, well, how do we get that on the agenda? Who's going to keep the agenda? How do you know, like all this round and around kinds of stuff? And eventually, you know, one thing a sponsor of mine actually said to me once, which was a very insightful comment, and it was just about, he was like, look, group conscience is a kind of group decision-making process, right? And in any group decision-making process, it's hard to make decisions until you agree upon how you're going to make decisions. And so to me, I've always kept that in the back of my mind. Like things like, are we a simple majority when we take votes? Is it a two-thirds threshold? When can somebody call a business meeting? Is there a regular business meeting? You know, on and on and on and on and on. But it's sort of like banging out the logistics first and trying to essentially get those building blocks in place first, because then once that's in place, it's a lot easier to just move through some things, in my experience. Part of the reason I say that is we were able through conscious effort to transform it from a definitely less than functional business meeting to what I would consider a very highly functional business meeting. You know, we've with COVID stuff, we've had a bunch of people from Europe and here and there and everywhere. And a lot of you, more than one person has been like, you guys have a really good business meeting. And I'm like, you should have seen us like, you know, 10 years ago. So there's hope is what I'm saying. So that's the first thing. I would also just say, like, so again, going back to this thing of what do I wish I had known as a newcomer? And one of them, you know, I'm going to sort of, in a bucket of different kinds of general topics, just throw out some general ideas that would have been very helpful to me had I known them then. And one of them is this, you know, I came in actually in NA, not ACA. That was my first program. And we have a saying there that clean time doesn't equal recovery. So just because someone's been there for a while doesn't mean they're recovering. So just words to the wise, you know. I would also say, as I said before, that, you know, we all have challenges. We all in ACA generally have challenges with boundaries. So we're working on that, and some of them are focusing on that more than others. I would say overall, when walking into a meeting, you know, I think there's some simple things that you can take a look at least get a rough back of the envelope sense of, how healthy is this meeting? The first thing I would say is, and it's in the red book, you know, when you're new, try a bunch of different meetings because different things work for different people. And, you know, what may work for Bob may not work for Sally, you know, and that's fine, you know. But I think there are some general principles behind meetings that tend to function better. And one of them is there a focus on steps and traditions in the meeting? Are there regular business meetings? Are there trusted servants that have regular rotation? Or do you have people who are sort of controlling it as like their meeting? You know, those are some pretty big guideposts. I would also say in terms of like the trusted servant thing, again, it's a trusted servant. It's a servant, at most, a servant leadership position. You're there for the benefit of the meeting, not the other way around, as a trusted servant. And so I think what that means, and very important to keep in mind as a newcomer, is nobody owns the meeting. It is no one person's meeting. It is the group's meeting. I would say, you know, so one thing that was confusing to me for a while is the relationship between a group conscience and a business meeting. And I would summarize it this way. A group conscience is the process of the group coming to a group decision, hopefully incorporating substantial unanimity, as was mentioned in the first share. And to me, the business meeting is sort of like the container within which that group conscience happens. So in my experience, it does wonders for a meeting to have like a regular, generally monthly business meeting. But you know, maybe some meetings feel like quarterly or something. But in my experience, have a regularly scheduled business meeting to regularly review the business of the meeting and go through the group conscience process works wonders. I would also say that, and this is kind of like a more subtle thing, but in when you think about the meeting and how the meeting feels, does it feel like it's about understanding and healing and growth, or is it about control? Because I've definitely been at meetings where there's a heavy degree of just control permeating the atmosphere. And in my experience, that is kind of oil in water with actually understanding and growth, which is the path I'm trying to be on in my recovery. I will say, I do want to tell kind of like a personal story that happened actually.
Josh, that's 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you. I got 3 minutes, so I'll wrap it up. I'll start wrapping it up. This was actually in a meeting. This happened probably about a year and a half ago. And I was I had a home group. And this was actually in another fellowship, but all the same principles apply. And there was one person in the meeting who kind of had started the meeting with one other person. And very much felt a sense of pride and some sense of ownership with this meeting. And there was, I noticed over a series of years how she kind of interacted with her sponsees in a way that always kind of left my stomach turning a little bit, where it was very, I mean, at least to me, it's very much a like, you should, you will, I require all my sponsees to do. If you don't like that, go find another sponsor, you know? And so there was always this kind of, anyways, I just kind of let that, you know, whatever, that's somebody else's decision. But there was a business, it was always, whenever she was chair of the business meeting, there were always challenges because control issues always tended to come up. And there was one business meeting where basically we were going through a thing and I was like, I mentioned an issue that I wanted to get on the agenda for the meeting. And she basically was like, I as chair will not allow discussion of that issue. And I was like, does anyone else think this is a problem right now? You know, and she was like, we're not talking about that. And I was like, I'd like to get, and she was like, we're not talking about it. So I did. I was like, I sat there and I breathed. And I realized in this moment, I looked around the room and I saw, and it was like everybody was just like, their eyes were glazed over, right? I was like, if this is going to shift, if I'm the only one who says something, this just becomes a personality conflict between me and this person. So that's not going to do anything constructive. I looked around the room and I was like, is anybody else seeing this? And I could see like, half the people were freaked out, you know, another quarter were just kind of like, whatever, and a quarter were like shocked and didn't know how to process, like deer in headlights, you know? And so I was like, all right, this is not the time to push this any further right now. And what I did is I wrote it down on the agenda for the following business meeting of like, is the chair, like basically motion, chair is not allowed to determine what does and does not get on the agenda. And then that waited and it got on the next business meeting. And then the same person tried to kick the can down the road, tried to like say, oh, there's not enough people to have the business meeting. And, and this went on for like 2 or 3 months like that. And eventually it came up. And I had had some conversations with people offline. And I'm like, are you seeing what I'm seeing? And they were like, as I talked to people, they were like, oh, yeah, maybe that it, you know. And then finally the meeting came and we talked about it and got on the agenda. We talked about the specific issue. After much discussion, the group agreed that no, the group conscience will determine what goes on the agenda for the meeting. That person got very upset, claimed she was being personally attacked in the meeting and stormed out, and has since stopped attending that meeting. Now, while I wish that person would, I hope she is finding recovery maybe somewhere else. I also found it very interesting that when the group said, no, you're not allowed to do that, she didn't want to play anymore. But I think that that was a momentous decision for the group. And it could only happen by the group choosing to do something different. So that's what I got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Josh.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you all of you very much. And we didn't have a chance this evening to discuss group inventory, taking a group inventory of your meeting. But I want you to know that that when Lawrence was the head of our Connecticut intergroup, we did put together a group inventory document. It's up on the ACAWSO website under best practices. And we would really love it if you'd take a look and give us some feedback on that. We adapted it from a couple of other 12-step programs, but we thought that it was really good to actually have a process where a meeting could look at itself and say, how healthy are we? And of course, it has to do with, you know, not only business meetings, but how we treat newcomers and a lot of other things. So please do take a look at that. Also remember last week we had, or 2 weeks ago, excuse me, we had a panel on boundaries. Thank you for bringing those up. And that committee is just getting off the road. If you want to be on the boundaries committee, which will ultimately look at creating some sort of a document about boundaries, you can put something in chat and we will get back to you and let you know how to do that. So I'm going to, we did receive actually just 4 questions from members. And so I'm going to first of all, ask our panelists if they can address those questions. And I'm just going to throw it out to different panelists and you can certainly pass if you do not want to answer this question. So here's number 1. My question concerns a dispute between Zoom meetings and in-person meetings. Several of the regular attendees of a Zoom meeting do not want to attend in person. The in-person group has dropped the hybrid Zoom component of the meeting and stated that the intergroup Zoom account is not available for those who want to continue online. How can the online group resolve this? So you've had a split between, you know, the group was doing both in-person and Zoom, and the Zoom portion has been dropped, and now the folks have said the intergroup Zoom account is no longer available. Lawrence, do you want to address that question? I know. Well, you're number one, so... You can't use our Zoom. Yeah.
For myself, I fully understand if somebody does not want to engage in live meeting yet, that they are still paying attention to social distancing and COVID. It's a real thing. There's different levels for everyone as far as their risk level and everything else. That is an individual choice. But as being an individual, I would say that responsibility to find your recovery and to make or continue that recovery is not left in the hands of someone else. There is an alternative, and I believe we had that chat tonight about bringing it to a group conscience meeting.
Right. And it, this issue of who owns the intergroup Zoom account is actually an interesting question, probably more than we can discuss at this meeting tonight, but it's an interesting question. Who gets to use it? Who owns it and who gets to use it? So you're right. Question number two, how do you suggest passing the online meeting host responsibility to another member when the host does not ask for volunteers to take his place? So Karen, the question is, you know, the host is, I'm the host, I'm gonna be the host forever. And no other host need apply.
There's different aspects to that question. I would break it in two parts, because we have the technical question of like, how is the Zoom account managed? And I would also sort of freely admit that I am still learning Zoom. And so these whole issues that I saw you guys grappling with at the beginning of our discussion today, just like who gets to mute and unmute and turn on and off cameras and kick people out of the meeting if they're being disruptive. And pardon my French, is, I mean, being very explicit here, kicking them out, but just sort of basically blocking them out of the meeting. That's a new responsibility. We don't have that kind of a service position in face-to-face meetings. And I think the group conscience of each meeting should actually sit down and say, well, what is the job description for this particular job? And does owning the Zoom account mean that I have the authority to run the controls on each meeting that I'm on just because I happen to own the Zoom account? Or does that translate into a service position where I have some responsibilities to the group as a trusted servant? And then the conversation that the group needs to have is like, what are those responsibilities? What authority is the trusted servant going to be given to manage those, to handle those responsibilities? And how, what is, and then at that point is when the question comes up, like, how does the rotation of service work here? Like, how does ownership of the Zoom account versus handling the controls of the Zoom meeting, how does all of this work? And I just want to throw out one more thing that I think is something that we all need to think about, especially in this world where so many meetings are happening virtually. Essentially, ownership of the conference call line or ownership of the Zoom account is kind of like having a recovery club, or kind of like being the church that is offering 12-step groups to meet in their rooms. And so the relationship between the person who owns the account that the meeting is being hosted on and the group might need to be negotiated in the terms of a rental agreement of a meeting with a recovery club or with a church. And I think we're very much in the beginning of having these conversations and finding solutions to the problems that the technology is bringing with it. But I encourage us to just keep talking about it and raising these questions, because not having answers to questions doesn't mean we shouldn't be talking about them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Very wise. The next person says, I have a question in regard to ACA hybrid meetings. So my understanding is what that means is that some people are meeting in person and they also have a Zoom set up in the room. Some travelers have stated if they are required to wear masks, they will not attend. The commercial establishment states masks only in common areas. How should the group resolve this issue? Aaron, do you have any thoughts about that? Masks. You are muted.
Okay, thank you. I was looking at that question. So common areas, meaning is the common area where the meeting is occurring?
Of course, these questions are a little hard to decipher. I'm assuming that what this person is saying is that that if you're in the hallway, you have to wear a mask, but theoretically, if you're in the meeting room, you don't. So basically, I think they're saying is, should we have a mask rule? I assume that that's what they're asking.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it sounds to me like if this was happening in a meeting that I was going to go to, I would want to have this information discussed before I went back to a meeting. And, you know, I'm looking at the traditions here. So is there group unity? You know, is there group unity? If people are not going to wear a mask, how can we still keep that safe? How far do people need to be away? You know, what can we set up? Safety's got to be the most important thing, you know, in every aspect, emotionally, physically. Unity's there, you know, carrying the message, the newcomer, having those difficult conversations, all of this tradition. You know, it would seem to me that can this group work together to come to unity on this question? You know, you're gonna have probably the motion or the discussion, and then you're gonna take a vote, and then you're gonna hear the minority opinion. And if anyone changes their vote as a result of that minority opinion, then you can take that revote. But I think it comes down to a group conscience and unity. Yeah, the church has its rules, but the safety of the meeting, and you know, how healthy is that meeting to come together to answer that question for themselves? No, is there a right or wrong answer? You know, if I was, you know, in the situation where I am, I have an 83-year-old mother and a husband who has breathing problems. It's not going to be a safe meeting for me to go to.
Yeah. Thank you. And Josh, I had to laugh when I looked at question four because it seemed it was custom made for you. How can we ensure rotation of leadership when the meeting chair of a number of Zoom meetings is doing all the service jobs, seems to stall on posting an agenda item for new service positions, and manipulates the business meeting so there is never time at the end for us to bring up the issue? The situation is troubling and creating an unhealthy atmosphere. It is unclear how to break out of this organizational structure.
That's a good one. I would say, so that smells like control issues. And I think when you run into that, what you have to do is find ways essentially to not become dependent on that person to handle the task at hand. And there are multiple ways to do that. But I would say that one of them might be, how do we start talking about who keeps the agenda for the business meeting? Isn't that somebody different than the person who hosts the Zoom meeting? Maybe that gets to a discussion of roles and responsibilities and service positions, which is a very important discussion, you know? But I know one structure I'm used to is like, there's a chair and a secretary for the meeting, and then there's a chair and secretary for the business meeting. And those are four separate roles, right? And at least as I'm used to it, the secretary for the business meeting is the person who maintains the agenda and the minutes for the business meeting. And so if the host is the person playing maybe secretary in the main meeting, that's a different person than there, right? But I think another way to do it is to have co-positions. So it's never just one person doing that kind. There's always two sets of eyes on it.
Another aspect is to, I've seen this done in business meetings, which is to say, you know, yeah, the default may be we go through, you know, old business first, and then you go through new business, and then all of a sudden you never get to the new business meeting. You know, how does that happen? You know, explicitly discussing that the group can reprioritize the order of the items at any time. So you can be like, well, okay, yeah, I know by default it comes in this order, but if we feel like this issue is like the hot one and the group is in agreement about that, so let's all agree that that becomes item number one for the next business meeting. And maybe you have to wait a month to get to it, but everybody knows that, you know? That's another one. There are various other options, but those are the top ones that sort of come to mind. But they basically come down to undoing the concentration of that much responsibility in one person or one role.
Right. Thanks, Josh. We actually have some questions from members in chat, so I'm going to go through those as well. And I will just ask whatever panelist wants to handle the question to pick it up. So here's the first one. What does a meeting do if people in the meeting begin to suspect that an attendee might be dangerous for the membership? Someone, for instance, talking about dreaming about people or animals being killed and cut up. Can the meeting report this individual to the police? Who wants it?
Are you saying that the person is telling that they did that behavior?
I think that they're saying that they're dreaming about it. Dreaming about people or animals being killed. So basically it sounds like somebody in the meeting is triggering people because they're talking about violent things. And so the question is, what can we do about this person? And should we, can we report the person to the police? I don't know what for, but that's up to you guys. You're the panel.
I'd just like to, I want to add something with that.
Yeah.
I'd like to speak on that. Ultimately, any safety in a meeting is important. And I'll use the example of suicide. If someone speaks of suicide or shows any kind of signs that they may be considering suicide, and my own belly barometer goes off, my gut screams that something's going on here. As an adult, as an individual, it is my responsibility to report that to an authority that can address it. But with that being said, I don't have to do this alone. I can take into consideration my fellow travelers and bounce it with them. And actually, again, it's about the pink elephant. There's a pink elephant in the room, and I am going to talk about it. Thanks.
Thank you, Lawrence. Someone asks, what do I do if I get triggered in a business meeting? Do I leave? Uh-oh. you know the way the chat works? Chat has just moved on. I got triggered in a business meeting. What do I do? Is the question.
This is Erin. So what I would do for being triggered in a business meeting is similar to what I talked about with the delegate training, where go in with affirmations for myself. You know, like if I kind of know the environment of this business meeting is usually going to be people that I'm going to be triggered by, you know, I'm going to have my, you know, tackle the problem, not the person, choose curiosity over criticism. Just remember, we're all doing the best that we can, you know, so I would go in with those things to be able to regulate myself. But I would also wanted to say to the previous question, that personally, what I would do, because it was similar to a scenario that happened in our meeting, is after the meeting, I would go to the person and just say, are you okay? Is there anything, you know, is there anything, you know, I can help you with or talk to you about? I mean, because the meeting needs to be safe. And I just, you know, that's somebody who's crying out for help one way or another, you know, and a lot of drama there, but I would just say, are you okay? You know, cause it, you know, sometimes a person's going in there for whatever unconscious thing, you know, to, you know, startle or whatever, but, just being proactive and letting someone know that I care. I'm not coming back at, you can't do that. I'm coming back at, I care. Are you okay?
Thank you. So we've got a question, what to do when a member shows up drunk. And I think related questions have to do with what is the if you have someone in a meeting that you feel is disruptive, like right now, disruptive, does the group have to go to a group conscience to ask that person to leave? Or is there some other process in the moment that needs to happen?
Can I speak to this?
Of course.
Okay. And I'd like to tie this back, because I think this and the past two questions are all related, in my opinion. And I think one thing that's very, I think, important to keep in mind is that just because somebody feels upset, if B feels upset by A's behavior, that doesn't mean A did something wrong. And I think that sometimes, and I've seen this in meetings, that people can essentially consciously or unconsciously attempt to hijack the meeting because of claims of feeling triggered. And I would just say that sometimes a meeting has to decide what's actually going on here and in the primary purpose, what's best for the most number of people, or for the meeting in general, you know? So, you know, I remember, you know, and it depends, you know, if somebody does something and it's like really disruptive to, you know, 90% of the meeting, but if the same person did the same behavior in a different meeting and people didn't feel disturbed by that behavior, then maybe the thing to do is to have a group conscience about it. It's really, again, each meeting is autonomous, group conscience. And I don't think, you know, in relation to the previous question about, you know, if somebody comes in and they're reporting dreams of harming something, dream one, I would say dreams are very different than actions. I would also say that even hearing about those dreams might, to some people, feel very triggering. Is that enough to tell that person that they are not welcome to share those kinds of things in the meeting? I don't know. That's up to the group conscience, you know? But I think one of the things we do as adult children to look for the rules. And I think with some of these things, there aren't rules. It's what the group conscience decides. And sometimes even the group conscience process, I've seen this, comes up with what at least I consider to be the wrong decision. Now, at that point, the thing is, go find another meeting, right? It's not, like, you have to let the group go through its process. And then where they come out on that, then I get to decide how I feel about it. But honoring the integrity of the group process, I think, is very important. And there's, as Karen was saying before, you know, just because these questions don't have answers doesn't mean they're not important and worth talking about. So, thanks.
Thanks, Josh. We've got a really interesting question from one member who says, can a trusted servant call a business meeting without asking the group first? And can that person invite only selected people to the business meeting?
I'm going to say no. That sounds like so out of bounds. Sorry.
And no is a full answer.
Yeah.
Inclusivity is one of our traditions, so we can't exclude people.
Mm-hmm. Someone said that there was a member in a group that was distributing sensitive photographs of one member to other members in the group. What should we do? Karen.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm feeling a Karen feeling here.
Oh, you said Karen, not Aaron, right? Yeah. We always confuse when I hear
it. Sorry.
So the question is, let me just make sure I'm on board here. I was a little distracted because my microphone wasn't able to unmute on my end. The question is, an individual is distributing sensitive photographs of a member among other members of the group.
Correct.
I think that would absolutely be something to bring up to the business meeting of the group and just discuss rules of conduct and maybe also discuss anonymity and principles of anonymity that might apply in this situation. I feel like it's one of those situations where probably a small group of members should approach the person who's doing it and address the issue and just maybe counsel about this is not really how we do things around here. But definitely if it's something that persists despite some discussion and some counseling, I think it should be publicly called out and identified as a problem behavior. And also, I think it would definitely open up the avenue if it persists, because this can create a lot of negative feelings within the meeting. I think a meeting might want to consider asking the person in question to stay away for a while until whatever is triggering this particular behavior, until they've been able to resolve that.
Thank you, Karen. The last question that I've got on here is, somebody has the opposite problem to one person controlling all of the service positions. And that is, what do we do if we can't find people to take on the various service positions? How do we get a healthy meeting when nobody is volunteering?
I would actually like to speak to that. I think that's an important challenge, both for the meeting itself and for the person in the service position. Like in a service position rotating out, worrying about what's going to happen if I step down from the service position, are people going to step up, or is the service position going to be left vacant? And then what happens if the service position is left vacant? And I feel like that speaks to a really important trigger for us as adult children. I mean, I deal with it a lot, hyper-responsibility. I feel like the world is going to fall apart if I'm not watching everything closely every moment of the day. And I think, again, these are questions that the group, like on the group level, if service positions aren't being filled, the group needs to ask the question openly, is this service position really necessary? How is the service position advancing the common welfare of the group if nobody is feeling really a lot of inclination to step up and do this service position? And maybe we can eliminate this service position, and maybe at some point it'll become more pressing again to fill it, and then somebody will step up and do it. That's sort of on the group level. And on the personal level, I think it's really something where each of us needs to be very honest with ourselves about, like, what are my motivations for holding on to a service role? Am I afraid that everything is going to fall apart if I step down? And then sort of learning to trust that the group will work this out. I've been in meetings where there was no defined, no assigned chair position. And that worked for a long time. And then it stopped working because one person would come early to grab the box and be the chair because it was making them so uncomfortable. And then eventually the group decided, oh no, this isn't working. We need to assign a chair position and somebody needs to actually commit to doing this for 3 months or for 6 months. And then, groups do work these things out. And I feel like it's a big sort of trust, an experience in learning to trust, to let the group work these issues out for itself.
Thank you. And one of our members just commented in chat that that maybe a meeting that doesn't have people willing to take up service positions should actually close, and those members should find a meeting that's got more people that are active in service. So, you know, I know we're like, the thought of closing a meeting makes many of us like completely crazy. And sometimes it actually is the best thing to happen, but like, that's that control issue, right? Like, you can't stand the thought that this meeting might close. So some really, really good questions here. And I know we are coming up against the end of our time. So at least I have to go back to my script and do my job. So let me do a little bit of that at the moment. And thank everybody. And we will, remember, come back on August 8th. We can definitely talk about some of these things further, particularly issues of safety with these very same panelists on August 8th. So the topic for that meeting is meeting safety. And we would like to thank all of our panelists for joining us today. Thank you so very much. As we continue to observe the seventh tradition, contributions can be made to the Connecticut Intergroup treasurer directly. And that address is actually, I think it's in chat, or you could see it on our website, or you can go to the WSO website. And if that's what you want to do, you would go actually to the shop, because believe it or not, you make contributions by buying something at the shop. It's a little confusing, but it does work. Liz, anything else to say before we close with the Serenity Prayer?
Thanks for everybody's attention and being here. Everybody who sits in a chair is doing service for the group. That's it. So thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you to our panelists. We'll look forward to seeing you back again on August 8th. Just everybody note, it is a new time. It's going to be at 2 p.m., correct? 2 p.m.?
Correct, 2 p.m.
And our reasons for that, among others, are that we want to see if we can get some of our worldwide fellowship to be able to come to the meeting, because a 5 o'clock meeting for them is, for many of them, is bedtime. So please join me, if you will, in closing out the meeting with the ACA version of the Serenity Prayer.
God, grant me serenity. The people I cannot change.
Courage to change the one I can.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. Amazing experience.
If anybody from the panel wants to stick around for one more second, there's another question in the chat, which we could answer if people have more time.
I can stick around.
Right.
Sure. I don't mind.
Can someone speak to the option of calling for an emergency business meeting that may need to wait 2 or 3 weeks, or maybe a problem that needs a group conscious call right there during the meeting?
I'll give a quick thoughts on that. One of the things that it reminds me of is crosstalk, and what crosstalk looks like in a meeting, and the Big Book describes that if there's any crosstalk whatsoever that's taken place in a meeting, that a good suggestion is that right then and there, someone can raise their hand and ask that the crosstalk statement be read so that everyone understands no one's being accused of the crosstalk, but again, it's coming to the forefront and upfront attention to the group that there may be crosstalk taking place. Please be mindful. So when you have an issue that needs to be addressed right away, the group is autonomous. They create their own group in whatever shape or form that is. They have the ability to say, listen, an issue has come up. We need to take a look at this right away. It can't wait. If anyone is interested at processing this issue today, there will be a business meeting afterwards so that we can take care of this while it's needed to take care of, even if it's a temporary answer. Thanks
Lawrence. Anybody else want to add anything to that?
I can. This is Josh. I would say that there's an interesting tension that this question is putting its finger on. And I know, so some meetings have a group conscience decided upon rule that you can call a business meeting, but it has to wait at least a week or two. And the reason that I've heard given for that is because you want to make sure that everybody who would want to be at a group conscience to speak to and hear more about that issue has opportunity to hear about that this issue is going to be discussed, so they have a chance to know about it and rearrange their schedule to be there if they're able to, as opposed to just doing some people, if you just did one there, then and there, that the idea is that could be, some people could understandably feel ambushed by that. And so there's a tension there, because I think, you know, and Brad, I think you asked this question, so maybe there's something you can, there may be some color here that you may be able to give or something. And I know there definitely may be certain issues that just feel like they cannot wait. And what I would say is, again, I probably sound like a broken record, but that's up to the group conscience. Like, if you have a really hot issue and you really want to talk about it, I think it's up to the group conscience whether or not they want to talk about it right now or not. I'm done.
Yeah. Thanks, Josh. I actually gave that as an alley oop for the panel members, is that it's always an option if things get bad enough to call a group conscience there. I visited a meeting before COVID, and an argument broke out during the meeting. It was very unusual. I hadn't seen something like that before, and someone called for the crosstalk rule to be said. But you know, if it hadn't stopped, then you know. I would have called for a group conscience right then and there. I mean, the meeting had broken down to a bit of craziness, and I think I was just going to say, if things get bad enough, you can always call for one right then and there and see if the group will do it.
This is Erin. Yeah, I've seen scenarios where a group conscience is called right then and there, or, you know, point of information because of something. And then, you know, so a decision is made then, if it needs to be made then, but then that same subject is taken to the next business meeting, if need be, to discuss it, you know, with everyone ongoingly, you know.
Okay, thank you. There is another question in the chat. Everybody has it there. It's from one individual to everyone. I will read it for those on the phone. I have a question regarding how to address the situation when you realize that a decision has been made for the group that was not made by a group conscience. The situation was that someone was asked to leave the meeting for 6 months, but not all members were informed that there was a process for this decision. In this situation, the person who was asked to leave was my sponsor, and it is possible that I was not informed of the decision because it was thought that I would not be impartial. Does it make sense to ask the group to address this situation after the decision has already been made?
This is Erin. Absolutely. This is where we learn from our mistakes. I mean, we apply the traditions to how it should have gone.
I would have to agree. It's that, to me, is a very serious issue that should be taken up as an informed group conscience decision, which is slow down and consider highly to be educated in making a good decision around this.
Oh. This is an interesting question that I don't know the answer to, which does not really pertain to the topic, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is anyone aware of a Zoom-only meeting intergroup being considered? It's an interesting question. I would suggest that person join the WSO Slack channel and ask it there.
There's two places to put that. There's a, now that we have the ad hoc meeting on service, safety and service, I forget how it goes.
It's a really long name.
Yeah, we will be scheduling a town hall to hear about all these different things, but so there's that committee, which is looking for members. And then there's also an open, it's the addressing, I think Mary Jo's on here and can tell me the name of that one. It's, where I can look on here. It's a hashtag on Slack. It's hashtag, I think, meeting safety, where you can go on to there and just ask questions and get some feedback from different people. But the ad hoc meeting, our first things that we're addressing is safety with online meetings and Zoom. So that might be a place to take that too. See if I can find the meeting safety. Addressing meeting safety. Hashtag addressing meeting safety.
And how do people get on Slack? Do you have to have an invite?
So yes, you do have to, how does it work, Josh, Erin? You send an email and through your email, you would be invited on Slack. You do that one.
All you have to do is anyone who's already on there just needs your email, and then I can send you an invite. So if you want to be on there and you're not already on there, like Liz, if they send it to you, you can just invite them from there.
Or oh, I can? Okay.
Yeah, and I can show you how to do that, you know, but it's the intention is for it to be open. So, you know, you want to make sure that you do some due diligence around the people who are on there are adult children and not just anyone, you know. So that's the process. So if you want to be in there, you can get in there. You just need to give someone your email address who's already in there.
So I'm seeing the chat is asking again for the three C's that I use, which is I can choose curiosity over criticism.
All right. So I am not very good at multitasking. I'm trying to answer chat questions. But I think that we have gotten to the end of the questions. If anybody has a burning desire to ask a question, you can raise your hand and I could call on you. Or we can end. Now you can hear that I type by hunting and pecking. all right. Well, thank you again to all of our speakers, and thanks for everybody's attention today. And we'll see you again on August 8th at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Great job.
Yeah, thank you, Brad, working in the background there.
Pleasure. And Christopher, I don't know if you guys knew, but there were two Zoom bombers today that were dealt with quite quietly.
Really? So,
yeah.
Yep. I don't know what the purpose of a Zoom bomber just messaging me privately is.
They are children of ACA.
Well, maybe one day.
That's a troll in the internet. They are bullies.
Bullies, yeah.
Yeah.
And Josh, again, I apologize. I didn't realize that you can't turn your video back on. I was like, oh, I just see an empty window there. Let me just kind of pause this video.
Yeah. I think.
And I didn't realize that you couldn't turn it back on yourself.
So I think there's a setting in Zoom that makes it such that, I believe this is true. If either one of the hosts mutes somebody or stops their video, or that person mutes or stops their own video, they then can't reinitiate it unless invited by one of the hosts.
Right.
So even if I mute myself, you have to give me permission to then unmute myself.
Right. And what I realized that I should have done, which is what I actually did with somebody else, was I sent a message saying, hey, I'm not sure if you're still here, so I'm just going to turn your video off for now. Let me know, you know, if you want it back on. I shouldn't, you know, should have done something like that. Just communicating with you. I had no idea.
Okay.
Same goes for lesson learned. People use. Because the Zoom bombers are known to change their names during meetings, so they can be muted or caught or kicked out.
Yeah.
Did you still want to stay, Liz, the panelists?
Who's the setting?